Hello, and welcome to the Customer Onboarding Podcast brought to you by TaskRay. I'm your host, Jamie Cole, Chief of Staff at TaskRay. And on each episode, I'll sit down with customer onboarding leaders to uncover the leading strategies, playbooks, and secrets to ensuring customer onboarding success within the first 90 to 120 days. I'm so excited for you to join us and listen to these industry leaders as we learn together how to be customer onboarding gurus. On today's episode, it's my pleasure to welcome Dan Steinman, Chief Evangelist at Gainsight, to discuss where customer onboarding should live in your post-sale organization, how to perfect handoffs between sales and onboarding, and what role product teams have in the onboarding process. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm happy to be here. Glad to talk to all of your audience. Great topic, really important, so looking forward to it.
Yes, I agree. It is a very important topic, and it's a hot topic. So you've been on the forefront of customer success from its emergence to its growth and then beyond. During that time, you've served as the Chief Customer Officer at Gainsight, the customer success company, having served previously as VP of Customer Success and other various post-sale leadership positions. Do you want to give a little bit more background on who you are and your experience?
Sure. I won't take the whole webinar to give my whole resume because it'll take a while. But I have been kind of doing post-sales things almost my whole career. Once I found that I actually liked working directly with customers, I kind of just followed that path. And somewhere in the mid-2000s, that thing started becoming called customer success, as opposed to customer advocacy or account management or customer relations or all sorts of other titles that we had. And so I kind of just stayed on that path because it was the thing that I enjoyed the most, and I think I became pretty good at it. So prior to Gainsight, I was the first VP of customer success at Marketo during their scaling years. And then I left there and joined Gainsight as Chief Customer Officer. I have done the chief evangelist role now twice, and in between that, I spent 3.5 years in London building our European operation as the general manager of Gainsight EMEA. So I've not only seen this personally at a number of companies where I was in charge of it, but I've also talked to literally thousands of companies over the last 10 years about customer success. And usually when I say customer success, I mean the whole customer experience, not just the CSM part of it, but onboarding and support and professional services and renewal process and training and all of the other things that kind of come under that umbrella.
So really the whole gamut of
everything. Yes. Yep. Yes. Yeah, I think the whole customer journey is really customer success. Now you could argue customer success starts with marketing and includes sales, and I think that's true. But organizationally, I think the way we now think about customer success is from the minute a deal is signed, a new business deal is signed, everything that happens after that is what we call customer success.
Right, is the industry definition of customer success.
Yeah, this Gainsight specifically, but I think the industry is migrating in that same direction.
So one thing I want to touch on really quickly that you just said, I think that this is a really important point, and I'd love to get your answer, is you realized you liked working with customers, and that's what set you off on your career as a customer evangelist, basically. Mm-hmm, what is it that you like about working with customers, and how do you identify that in yourself for a career path?
Yeah, I should probably put the word like in quotes.
Okay.
I really do like it, but what I found out was that I had the personality and the temperament that worked pretty well. Not necessarily as a salesperson. I think that's slightly different, although I did that for a couple of years. And I learned something really valuable, which is I never want to do that again. And that's fine. I think it's more important in your career to find out things you don't like than it is to find out things you do like. So I think I had the right personality and temperament to deal with customers. And I think when I say like, I think it's more about knowing that I can provide value to the company I work for as well as to the customer if I'm diligent and intelligent and trained on how to do that. So when I say like, I think it's not the same as when I say I like to play golf, but I do feel like there's a real joy that I get in a lot of instant satisfaction, which you don't often get in the business world, of having a value-driven conversation with a customer, and that's really what I mean.
Great. So given your breadth of experience and tenure in customer success, how have you seen customer onboarding develop as a specific function within that post-sale journey?
It's super critical. Everybody knows that. And very few companies sell software that doesn't require some onboarding process. So it is a part of every single company, regardless of what they call it, implementation or onboarding or whatever it might be, and regardless of the length of time it takes. For some companies, if you're really lucky, onboarding might take 3 or 4 hours. For other companies like Gainsight, it's typically going to be a 6 to 8 week process. If you're Workday or Oracle or SAP, it might be 18 month process or even longer. And a lot of companies, the onboarding process actually never really ends because you're always training and moving the ball forward and introducing new features. And I think that's one of the important things we need to think about. And that is, onboarding is a finite thing that happens right after the customer originally signs a deal. But onboarding is an ongoing thing as well, whether it's done by an onboarding specialist or a CSM. Every time we send a release, there's a quote unquote onboarding process that has to happen to get that customer to understand the value of what's in that release and how to best use it and how to set up for it if they need to reconfigure or things like that. So with all of that said, I think the vast majority of SaaS companies end up with a separate onboarding organization. And that is the first post-sales team that touches the customer. So the handoff happens from sales to onboarding. That's true at Gainsight. I think it's true at almost every single customer and company that I've talked to in the last 10 years. Now, I will take one little side note on that, and that is a true startup company. You've got 8 employees and 3 customers, none of whom are paying anything yet. Yeah. There's a very high likelihood that there is one person who's doing everything post-sale, support mm-hmm. and customer success and onboarding and services and renewal and everything else. That's really typical. It's absolutely necessary. There's people who can do that. They're super valuable to those startup companies. But I think it's important from a vision standpoint to know that over time, if you follow the not just the trend, but the fact that every single public SaaS company in the world has a separate onboarding team, a separate support team, a separate customer success team, a separate training team, a separate renewals team, a separate professional services team, right? That's where we're going to end up. And I think it's really important to know what the end game looks like as you're moving through those early days. So ultimately, I think because onboarding is so critical, I'm a firm believer that there's nothing as valuable in the customer lifecycle as the first 90 days after they sign a deal. And that is essentially when onboarding happens. So I think it needs to ultimately be a separate organization with their own metrics, their own leadership, et cetera. And that's the way that almost every successful SaaS company has done it.
Obviously, we feel the same way at TaskRay. We think the first 90 days are crucial.
Yeah.
I'd be interested from your perspective, what do you think it is about those first 90 days that makes them so crucial to the customer lifecycle?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jamie. And it sounds like a really obvious question with an obvious answer, but there's parts of it that are a little bit nuanced. Here's one thing I've learned. One of the reasons that a customer signs a contract with a vendor is that they have decided to trust that salesperson. And there's usually a salesperson from 3 or 4 different companies involved in that process. Very seldom is it just one vendor being looked at. So it's a really interesting thing to me that the minute a customer decides to fully trust that salesperson, they sign a deal, and the next thing that happens is the one person that they trust in that company disappears from their life, right? And I really firmly believe this. Every single buyer has some buyer's remorse inside of them that's waiting to come out. And the most likely time for that buyer's remorse to come out is when the person they trusted goes away, a new person or team is introduced to them. And in that world, you cannot raise the excitement level or the value to the customer. You can only keep it at the same place, right? Because now that they've bought, that's the peak of their excitement until sometime down the road when they're actually getting tremendous value out of your product, but they're super excited about it. And now the grind starts, right? There's got to be meetings and planning And oftentimes they find out that the product isn't quite as slick as it might have looked like in a demo, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that level of excitement tends to go down. The best you can do is keep it level. And this is the onboarding team's job to set expectations properly, to keep the excitement as high as possible, but to manage that handoff such that the drop-off in the excitement level is as small as possible, and you get it back up to where it was as quickly as possible. That's a hard thing to do. And those buyers, I think many of them, especially if they're new buyers, they're like, okay, I've now been handed off from sales to something else. I bet this is when they put my money in the bank and they never call me back, right? There's a little bit in every one of us that's like, I wonder if I just got scammed, right? Even if you know for sure that's not true, there's a little something. And there's this hyper focus and hypersensitivity because of that. So I think we need to manage that really, really carefully. And if we do that, and then we deliver on the promise that was made during sales, then they can exit the onboarding process feeling at least as good as they did when they entered it, maybe even a little bit better. But most of the time, over some period of time, that excitement has dropped off a little bit and real life has kind of sunk in.
Yeah.
But I think we need to know that, but we need to manage that as carefully as we can.
Great. So you've had the opportunity, obviously, to see how numerous companies approach onboarding for success. What are some components of a successful onboarding program?
Yeah, there's a few things. One is, I think as companies grow, one of the first things you have to do is you have to realize that you can't afford to treat all of your customers the same way. Another word for that is segmentation. Now, segmentation is really interesting. We need to do segmentation for the reason I just said, but we also need to keep in mind that our customers do not want to be segmented. They all want to be treated in the best possible way. Sure. But we just can't afford to treat a customer who's paying us $10,000 a year the same way we treat a customer who's paying us $3 million a year. We just can't do that. And they know that too, by the way. So step number one, I think, is to understand clearly internally, what is the process? What is the journey we want to take each customer through? And that will vary by segment. That's the reason we segment, is we have to vary the customer journey. So it's less expensive for customers who are paying us less money. So step number one is to set expectations properly in the customer's mind. That actually has to start in the sales process. In order to be really successful at onboarding, your sales team has to be totally honest and set expectations properly with the customer. Because if we set expectations here and what we do is here, by definition, we're disappointing the customer. So we need to make sure that's aligned. If we do that and then we kick off with a customer, we say, here's the journey we're going to take you on. Here's the touch points that we're going to do. Here's the data we're going to track. Here's the project goals, here's the time goals, et cetera. And then we live up to that. Now we've brought that customer along without having them drop off in their excitement level because we've delivered exactly what we said we were. And if sales set expectations properly and we follow through, set expectations or reset expectations and then manage that journey just the way we told the customer we would, then we come out of that smelling really good. If we don't do that, any drop in any of those balls and the customer journey becomes less than desirable. So I think step number one is get the journey right, understand that internally, and then make sure we share that with the customer. Like, I want to say to my customer, thank you for being a customer. Here's step one of your post-sales world as a customer as opposed to a prospect. And here's the journey we're going to take you on. Here's what you should expect from us. Here's what we expect from you, and start that process of making it a partnership. And if you do that really well, I think then you can successfully deliver the value that you know your product can deliver.
Yeah. So it's maintaining that trust by being
that's right,
transparent and yep, executing well.
Yep. Yeah. It's kind of reestablishing trust because it's a new person. So yeah, you need to reestablish it. But once you do that once, I think if sales hands off properly and onboarding picks that up and reestablishes trust, then the customer's buyer's remorse kind of goes away. It's like, okay, I've gotten through that first thing. I bet the rest of the journey is going to be pretty straightforward and they're going to do a good job of managing me through the rest of the journey as well. Now, there'll still be a little bit of trickiness to each of those handoffs, But I think that first one is by far the biggest one.
Yeah. Well, so that is a great segue into the main topic of the day around handoffs. So obviously universal to every onboarding function, regardless of where it lives in the process, is the handoff.
Yep.
And perfecting the handoff between sales and onboarding is specific to each organization. It's often where organizations fumble the relationship with the client. Because as you said, I agree, sales is like an emotionally charged time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Gardner calls it the trough of disillusionment.
That's
after
right.
You purchase something and everyone kind of feels that way. You're like, oh gosh, what did I just do? So what are some of the components of the most successful handoff processes you've seen?
Yeah. Yeah. It starts, I think, with a good relationship between, we'll call it onboarding and sales, in that sales feels an obligation to set customer expectations properly and to gather relevant information during the sales cycle that will help their teammates on the post-sales side. Now, salespeople always do this, whether they're conscious about it or not, because in order to sell something to the customer, you need to understand what their business pain is and prove to them that you can solve that business pain. And typically, there's an implied, if not very specific ROI associated with that. Because a salesperson often has to go through an ROI conversation, a business conversation about business value with the customer. All of that information needs to transfer to the onboarding team. Because universally, the one thing customers hate and it makes them nervous is when the new person starts to ask questions that they've also already answered one or more times prior to that. This is classically the how come the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if the onboarding person starts the first conversation with a new customer by saying, so tell me, why did you buy our product? That's a really bad way to start.
Yeah.
The best way to start is, let me summarize some of the things we think we learned during the sales process that are going to be relevant to how we configure your system, how we get you through onboarding, and how we set you up for value. And then you rattle off the things that the salesperson learned. Ideally, potentially on that very first call, the salesperson is actually on that call. And some of that is talked about. And that's a real reassurance to the customer. Like, this is a real live handoff. Now, you can't do live handoffs with some of your lower end customers because that's pretty expensive to do. If you can, it's great. If you can't, that's okay. Just make sure that there's a set of things that are understood by the salesperson that they have to transition in a really good way to the onboarding team. And that starts with, why did you buy our product? Because in a SaaS world, a subscription world, the most important thing that we keep in the top of our mind as a post-sales organization is, why did this customer buy our product?
Yep.
We have to prove that they got the value for which they were buying our product. That's how we get a renewal done. That's how we get upsells done, right? So that's the most important thing. Other things that are also important are, you know, what does the infrastructure look like? Don't ask the customer what their CRM system is, because for sure your salesperson learned that during the process. Also really important is the personality of the people that you're going to have to deal with. Like, a good salesperson should sit down with the onboarding team and say, here's Joe, he's the executive champion, he signed the deal, here's his expectations, he's a really good guy, loves working with people, his team loves him, etc. Here's John, he's going to be your point of contact during the onboarding process. He is a pain in the keister.
Yeah.
He's a really ornery guy. He's never happy about anything. His personality is grating. He's really good at XYZ, but he's going to be a tough cookie, right? That is incredibly valuable to the onboarding team. What are the personalities I'm dealing with? So this whole world of what's the value, what did we tell them, how did we set their expectations, what did we learn about them, and who are they as people? All of those things need to become knowledge that the onboarding team inherits from the sales team in order to pick the ball up and really run with it.
Yeah. No, that is great. I have seen that firsthand, actually.
Yep.
At TaskRabbit, where, you know, there's a champion and then the project or the onboarding actually gets handed off to someone who was not involved in the purchase, and there's a lot of resistance. And so knowing that going into it is important.
That's such a good point, Jamie, because in most cases, that's a fact, right? We sell to a VP level who may or may not involve the people under them in the decision process.
Yep.
Even if he involves some of them, he doesn't involve all of them. And so the people who are actually going to be implementing and using your product may not know anything about it, may not be happy with the decision that was made, and may be very unhappy with the fact that they weren't involved in the decision, right? And we see this all the time. I had this experience the other day. I saw a product because we replaced one product with another. I saw it. I made a comment about it, how there was one thing that I didn't like because I liked it in the other system. And it was like, it was really deflating to the team that had gone through a really rigorous process to choose a better product for us. And I kind of callously just got my gun out and started firing away. And this is natural, kind of, we're human beings, right? So these things happen. But I think being really conscious of those kinds of personalities can be really helpful.
Yeah. So how would you recommend that organizations approach trying to understand their own process and optimizing it for success, since that's the first, really the first step for overall success?
Yeah. Yeah. This is kind of add on to the last question, which is, how do you do that handoff process? Not just what does it need to contain, but how do you do it? I think, as I said, ideally, I think for the most strategic, which typically means most complex customers, the sales person, the sales team actually should sit down with the onboarding team and have a conversation. What did we learn? What are you walking into? What are the complexities? What are the challenges here? If it can't be done face-to-face, there can at least be an email introduction. Hey, thank you for buying from me. I'm here to help if I can, but your point person going forward is going to be Joe, and he has a project team to do onboarding for you. They're great. I've had many of my customers come back to me with their happiness with our onboarding team, et cetera, right? A little bit of a sale to instill some confidence with the customer. And then at the low end, maybe, depending on how you do it, that might be an email. You know, thank you for being a customer. Click here to schedule a meeting with your onboarding team. Be confident that we've captured all the data during the sales process, however you want to say that. So there's different ways of doing that. I'll share a mistake I made. When I was at Marketo, I got really excited about doing this really well. So I created a document that I asked the sales team to fill out. It was like a 3-page document. I tried really hard to keep it pretty small. You fill out this document and then we'll take it from there. Well, if you have a document for salespeople to fill out that has more than a question, what's your name on it, it will not happen. So that was a total disaster. That was just like, I was way too old to be that naive about what a sales team would do for us. So we said, okay, that didn't work. But what we did was, as soon as we got a handover from the salesperson, we scheduled a meeting with the salesperson and we sat down and we got out that document and we went through it line by line by line and just asked them the questions, and they were willing to answer them. They just didn't want to fill out a document. So you have to understand the kinds of people that you're dealing with, the personalities of the people you're dealing with. So I think the handoff can be, and actually will have to be different for your different segments, because that one where it's a whole team meeting, that's expensive.
Yeah.
And then especially if you duplicate that again with the customer, where it's the sales team, the customer team, and the onboarding team, that becomes really expensive. And as you go down your pyramid of customers, you have to find a way to cut costs out of your process. That's why at the low end, it might be an email interaction. And in fact, for self-serve customers, it clearly has to be an email and then some guidance and a pointer to the frequently asked questions and a link to the community and here's how you contact support and things like that. But there is no one-on-one meeting that ever happens in a lot of cases. So I think you have to be really aware of that. And that's another reason that for setting the expectations of the customer properly, because they probably know some of your other customers, some of whom are in a higher tier, who are getting this white glove, red carpet, high touch treatment. And now all of a sudden they're going through an email process. They're going to be like, wait a minute. Hey, my buddy over at XYZ company tells me that you guys love him and meet with him all the time. And
yeah.
You have to say, well, yeah, if you can pay us $2 million a year, we will do the exact same thing with you.
You get a bat phone too if you pay $2 million a year.
Yeah, exactly. Right. In fact, this is one of the reasons that I recommend for the whole customer journey, you give customers in the lower segments the option to buy up to the top segment. Not because they'll ever do it, because they won't, because it'll be way too expensive for them. But at least you remove their ability to say, how come you don't have a high touch program for me? And the answer is, we do. We offered it to you. It's $87,000 a year. You're paying $8,000 for our product, so you said no to it. Yeah. But if you want it, it's still available. Get out your checkbook. And this isn't to shame customers, but the way to cut off some of that disillusionment is to give them the option of buying into one of those higher touch programs, because they're really expensive to deliver. And customers are business people too, and they know this. You have to remind them frequently because they don't want to admit that they know it. But it's okay to say to a customer, we can't do that because you're just not paying us enough money to have that level of touch. And they'll get that. They may not like it, but they will get it.
Hey, listeners, we'll get back to the show in a minute. But first, I wanted to ask you a question. Is your handoff process between sales and customer success repeatable, scalable, and optimized around your customer outcome? Could your process use some work? Check out our webinar, Mastering the Post-Sale Handoff, available on our website at taskray.com. Let's get back to the show. So my background is in marketing before I took on the chief of staff role. And so messaging to customers mm-hmm. that, hey, you're not in this segment is a hard thing to do. Yeah. But that answer that you just gave around the option to buy into the higher level touch is great, because freedom of choice is ultimately yeah. what I think most people want. And you're right. They would understand anyone saying, hey, from a cost perspective, mm-hmm. we can't support it at these lower levels, but you're free to buy these higher tier packages.
And back to something we touched on earlier, Jamie, this is why you need to, when you sit down with a new customer, you need to explain to them, here's your journey. Yeah. And you can even in that situation say, here's the tier that you've fallen into because of the price that we've given to you. That tier includes a world-class onboarding experience. And then you explain it to them, whether that's really high touch yeah. or tech touch. In both cases, you can say, this is a world-class onboarding experience. It's worked for hundreds of other customers. And you don't have to apologize. You don't have to say, I'm sorry, we can't talk to you every week. We're just going to send you emails. No. You just explain to them that the segment of customers that you're in, based on how much you've paid for our product, gives you this world-class onboarding experience. But it's all about setting those expectations and then living up to them.
You talked a little bit about an onboarding team, or onboarding as a specific business motion, and then staffing that with a team when you get to a certain size and scale at yep. your own company's life cycle. And that's separate from ongoing customer success. Do you think onboarding should be underneath customer success umbrella, or underneath the customer yeah. success team, or managed in parallel?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jamie. Organizationally, this is this can be sometimes pretty tricky. So I'm going to go back to something I said earlier, which is at in this point of our conversation, when I say customer success, I'm going to be referring to the whole post-sales organization. Because that's really what delivers customer success, all of the touch points once a prospect becomes a customer. And so I think in the ideal scenario for a mature company, there is one organization headed by one person, which is a title that's typically now called Chief Customer Officer. And the Chief Customer Officer owns the entire customer journey. So that means onboarding and customer success and customer support, and training probably, and ongoing professional services, and maybe renewals and upsell. Those are post-sales motions, but they're also sales motions. So that can fall under the chief customer officer. Most companies actually put renewal and upsell under the sales organization because those are sales motions. That one can, I think, fit in either place. But in this world then, the CEO has one person to go to if the customer journey is not working, right? It's the one throat to choke kind of a thing. It's what CEOs really like. That's why the title CRO became in vogue a while back, because you could put marketing and sales under one person. And then the CEO only had that one person to go to talk about the whole revenue funnel. That didn't play out quite as well as a lot of us thought it would back in the day when I was at Marketo. But the chief customer officer thing is a real thing, and I think it actually works really well. That's a very difficult job because each of the organizations are very, very different underneath that. It's valuable to the CEO. It's valuable to the customer because the whole journey is owned by one person who can think about it end to end. And then most importantly, can think about not different organizations under them, but a pool of resources that they can deploy to provide the best possible experience to the customer. So the best CCOs don't think about, oh, that's a support thing and this is a customer success thing. They think about who are the best people. And what that sometimes means is who are the least expensive people to deliver this level of value that we promise to this customer. Because some of this is about running a viable, profitable business, which means you don't have your most expensive person in the post-sales organization answering questions about how to log in for the customer. You just don't do that. And so I think the best CCOs really look at that whole pool of resources and say, who's the best person to do each of these different things? And let's stop thinking about hard lines between the organizations. There are some of those. Those hard lines are usually defined by metrics, but there's a fuzziness to this too that I think can be really valuable because the best organizations utilize their people in the best way to deliver the best experience to those customers.
I agree. There is a specific motion and there are some boundaries, but then the people are different costs with a lot of journey. And then one of the things that you just said was around metrics. And so metrics is a super hot topic in onboarding and I think customer success in general. What do you think the top metric or metrics should be for onboarding?
Yeah, super question. By the way, I think the reason that these different organizations become different organizations as a company matures is largely because of metrics. Because having done the CCO job, I wanted organizations that were driven by one primary metric. So for example, I'm managing customer support and professional services. I have them separate because they're very different jobs, they're different skill sets, but they're also very different metrics. The key metric for a support organization is usually efficiency. How many cases can we close per customer support rep per day? It's a cost center. It is and always will be a cost center. So it has to be measured on efficiency. Professional services as a analog is a very different organization, obviously different skill set. And the metric for a professional services organization is usually utilization. What percentage of their total hours are billable? Because we have to make a profit or at least break even on professional services, unless we're doing it for another reason, maybe to drive sales, et cetera. So it's not a universal truth, but the universal truth is that's the way we measure professional services on utilization. So I can't munge those organizations together because then I lose my visibility into the metrics because different people, and you can't measure an individual if they're doing two different jobs. You can't measure them very effectively. So this is why customer success as a CSM, I mean, and onboarding have to be separated. Because if the same person is doing both of those jobs, how do you know if they're good at their job? Because those two jobs are very different. Mm-hmm. The key metric for me in the onboarding process is what we call time to value. Now, that's a really fuzzy metric because the word value can mean almost anything you want it to mean. But I think every company has to figure out what is the initial value point for a new customer, and that's what you should be measuring in your onboarding team. How long does it take to get us to get a new customer to a point of value? You define value however you want, but make sure you're consistent quarter over quarter. Because as a CCO, here's what I want to do. I want to say to the person running onboarding, our time to value last quarter was 41 days. This quarter, it needs to be 36. And next quarter, we're going to get to 29. And the quarter after that, we're going to get to 25, right? This is the driving metric for you as the leader of the onboarding team. Go make that number. And what that typically means is don't just go work harder, but go figure out how to make that number. And that's what drives what I call healthy tension, because what you'll get out of that is the onboarding person realizing they can't get from 41 to 36 by working harder. The only way to get from 41 to 36 is to go pound on the product team to make the product easier to configure and easier to install. And by the way, this is what makes a company better, is when organizations are putting pressure on other organizations to get better at your job so my job becomes easier. We talked about this earlier. Make sales do their job setting expectations properly so that I can live up to those expectations. It's way easier to sell if you lie to a customer. And I'm not saying salespeople do that. Most right. salespeople really aren't unethical, despite what all sorts of memes might say about it. But it is much easier to sell to a customer if you're okay with lying to them. Telling them the truth and getting them to buy is harder, but it sets that customer up for success. So customer success has to force sales to be better at their job. Onboarding has to force product to build a better product to make it easier to install. Customer success has to make support do their job better so that customers, when a customer support case is closed, are actually resolved and the thing actually works and they understand why, et cetera. So I think, although it's fuzzy, time to value is the most important metric for onboarding. Now, there's other things too, like you have to manage the project. Are you delivering the project on time and within the hours that you priced for that particular project? So there are lots of other metrics, but that one overriding metric I think we call time to value is really important. And here's ultimately why. Because no customer will renew their contract if they're not getting value. They will also not do upsells. They won't buy anymore until they get value. And they won't do references or renewals or case studies or speaking engagements or anything else of value until they're getting value, right? So the quicker we can get them to value, then the quicker we can get something more out of them that we'd like to get out of them.
Right. No, that's a really good point. Well, so this is great. Another great segue into the next topic of conversation today around how product and customer onboarding interact.
Yeah.
So the role of product teams in the onboarding process. Products with freemium models or trials have seen the need for product's involvement in designing the onboarding process to make mm-hmm. sure there is customer success. What do you think the role of product should be in the onboarding process?
Yeah, there's a few things here. This is such an important topic. We could talk about it probably for a couple of hours. Yeah. But I think that back to this idea of having a driving metric and needing help from around the rest of the company to make that metric. By the way, this is the way sales operates. We give the sales leader a sales number. They don't make that number by just working really hard and staying in their offices and minding their own business. A good VP of sales is always out in the company pounding on other people's desks saying, you better make me a better product. It has to have these three features because our competitors have those features and they're killing us. And unless you build them for me, I can't sell our product and we're all going to starve to death. This conversation happens every single day, right? So this is how VPs of sales work. And we need to think about that the same way in the post-sales world. So an onboarding leader has to push on the sales team. Like, I need that product to be able to be installed in 2 hours. Currently, it takes 8. I need to get that down to 2. And then I need the configuration to be something the customer can do themselves instead of me having to do it. So I can teach them how to do that in an hour instead of taking 10 hours to do it myself, right? So I think product has to be intimately involved. And in fact, I think when onboarding isn't working very well, one of the solutions to that is get a product manager and an engineer to sit through a few onboarding projects and understand what the challenges are. Because I think it's easy for an onboarding person to think, well, this is hard, but this is just the way we have to do it. But if an engineer was sitting next to them, they would be like really nervous about the fact that they know they could build a script that would do in 10 minutes what it just took that onboarding person 3.5 hours to do. Right. And they are so anxious to go do that. Engineers hate it when their product doesn't do all of the things that it could easily do.
Right.
So I think product has to be forced to be intimately involved. And I say product meaning both product management and potentially engineering. That's one thing. The second thing that's happening in our industry is that more and more of the onboarding has to be done by the product and in the product, not by other people. So as an example, I think the idea of training is going to go away completely as a separate organization. And that's going to become the responsibility of a product manager, because there's so many tools now that allow you to train the customer how to use the product while they're using the product.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true. There's a lot of great tools that allow you to help the customer onboard the product while they are using the product from inside of the product, right? Gainsight has a product that does that. There's a number of other products that do that. But just think about the value of, here's the way I think about it. Let's say on a scale of 1 to 10, we have to get the customer to 10 during the onboarding process. That's yeah. configuration and knowledge and skills transfers and all sorts of other things. What if the product could get that customer to 4 or 5 without a person involved? Guess what? We've just cut half the cost out of the onboarding process and improved the customer experience enormously, because they don't have to interact and go back and forth and have meetings. They can actually do it from within the product. So I think product's real long-term role in onboarding is to actually make the onboarding process possible from within the product. Now, that'll never be 100% true. There'll always be some things people have to do, but I think product's vision has to be, we should be able to make the product install itself and configure itself and teach the customer how to use it, so no person ever has to be involved in that process.
Yeah, that is fascinating. That actually makes a lot of sense, because then it frees up the humans that you have dedicated to onboarding and customer success and support to actually build relationships and help with the things that will never be solved.
Yeah, that's exactly right. To do much more valuable and strategic things.
Yeah.
Not pushing buttons,
right,
but having business conversations.
Yeah. Well, and there's a really fascinating paper that we've read internally at TaskRay by the Marketing Sciences Institute that suggests that there are a finite number of interactions you get to have during the onboarding period before your customers start to think that you're not great.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
And you don't want to waste those on things that could be automated or could be built into the product. You want them to be the higher level interactions that are driving the human connection.
Yeah, early on at Gainsight, we even coined a phrase for this, because early on in a company, your onboarding process isn't very good. There's gaps in your product. You need really smart people to plug all of those gaps and build great relationships. So even when things aren't going well, the customer still kind of likes you a little bit.
Yep.
We call it Gainsight weariness. If you have to interact with a customer so many times and the process takes too long, people just get tired of the word of your company or the name of your product.
Yep.
Like, don't say that word. I'm so tired of hearing that every day. We got to deal with that. So that was a real thing for us like 6 years ago. I think we've gotten out of that, but there's always a chance of falling back into that, especially when you get into something really complex or the people situation isn't quite right. If the wrong person is trying to do a job that they're not capable of doing, or the customer's not participating in the way they should, you can still easily fall into that situation. And I think there's a saturation point with regard to your product and your onboarding process. That's why we have to keep reducing time to value, because we may not be done with the onboarding process, but if we can say to the customer, man, you're already using 60% of our product and I know you're getting a ton of value out of it. And we have to be able to remind our customers of that, because they forget very quickly what we've done for them and they worry only about what we haven't done for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you think are some of the positive effects of involving product teams in the onboarding process?
Yeah, first thing is the product gets better. It just does, because those people don't idly sit there and watch something that's really hard and say, oh, I'm sorry, that's hard. They think about how they can make it better. And a good onboarding person will have lots of ideas as well. I always tell my customer success and onboarding teams, it's not your job to redesign the product. It's your job to understand the challenges and clearly articulate those to the product team and let them figure out how to redesign it. Because we would redesign it to solve this one little problem. They will redesign it to solve that problem and make it much easier to solve these other 27 problems as well. So I think that's why that's a special discipline and yours is a special discipline. So don't get too much into the crossover of those things. So the product will clearly get better. Second thing that will happen is I'll do a little quick tangent here, and that is prior to the advent of real CSMs, product managers were directly involved with customers all the time because they basically did a lot of customer success. So they knew customers and they were really intimate with some of the customer challenges. The advent of customer success has kind of put a barrier between the product team and the customers because the customer success people do most of that. Getting product involved with onboarding and involved with customer success recreates some of that intimacy with customers. And the more a product manager or an engineer knows about how customers are really using our product, what their real problems are, what they wish the product could do, et cetera, the better off they are. In today's world, big part of the job of the CSM is to transfer that information to the product team. Hey, here's what our customers wish they could do with our product. Here's what they're trying to do. Here's what one of them did with the product that we never imagined anyone would ever try to do. This happens all the time. But it's not the same as if the product manager or engineer are directly involved with the customer. And we don't want that to happen too much because that takes a lot of time. But the more that happens, the better off I think everybody is. Like, simple example, the more often a CEO talks to a customer, the more they understand the challenges that those customers have. And so we don't want that to happen all the time because it'll create chaos in the rest of the organization. But we want that to happen a lot. So we don't have to explain to the CEO, here's what our customers are going through, and have them say, well, that shouldn't happen, or I don't believe that's really happening. They know for sure firsthand that those things are really happening.
So one of the things that I've noticed, I was running the product organization last year at TaskRay, and I definitely believe that I know firsthand that having that interaction between product and the CS org has a healthy tension. But it can be super productive if done well. One of the things that I found really challenging was getting people, the CSMs or in customer onboarding team, build relationships. And there's a trust factor of opening up those relationships to the product and engineering org. Do you have any tips about how to build that trust?
Yeah, some things I've learned the hard way. This was one of them. It's really easy for a product team or engineering team to assume that every single time a CSM calls them or comes into their office, they're just parroting whatever a customer has said to them. They haven't put any other thought into it. And what they can easily believe, unless you remind them, is that all the CSM does is bring every problem the customer has to the product team. So what I tell my CSMs, you need to interact with the product team and you need to be forceful about it. You need to bring the voice of the customer and you need to be somewhat demanding with them, but you also owe them some level of knowledge of all of the reasons that you and all of the different things you've said no to a customer about. So if you can say to the product manager, hey, I've said no to the customer on these 9 things because I know we don't want to do them, they've asked for them, but this one I think they really need and I think it would be valuable to a lot of my other customers. And what you're saying to the project manager is, or the product managers, I'm not just bringing you everything. I'm not just a yes person to the customer. I push back on them. I help them find workarounds. And I bring to you only the things that I think are really critical and are most valuable, not only to them, but hopefully to other customers as well.
Wow, that is a very helpful tip.
So that builds credibility, right? Yeah. The fact that they know that you're saying no to the customer or helping customers with workarounds, that everything doesn't fall back on the product team. And then I think that gives you the ability to be a bit more demanding on those things that you know really are valuable.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
We are coming to the end of our hour here, so I have one last question for you. If you had one piece of advice for customer onboarding leaders, what would it be?
Yeah, I think it would be own it. And what I mean by that is, back to what we said a few times earlier, your job is not just to make sure your customers are successfully onboarded. Your job is to make your company a better company that allows your customers to be onboarded more successfully. And a lot of that is, you know, like I said before, push back on the sales team. Don't let them demo the product in a way that it doesn't actually work. We can't let sales do that anymore. Don't let them oversell the product. Don't let them set expectations too high. I think we have to give them a little bit of leeway because they want to build excitement. So we can't say, stop saying great things about our product because it really isn't that great. No, that's taking it too far. But own it by pushing back on sales. Own it by making sure product is helping you to deliver what you need for the customers. Own it by demanding that there is a customer advisory board and that the onboarding process is part of that conversation so that other people in the company really do hear from customers. So, and I think the best leaders, if you're a CEO or a C-level or a VP-level person, the best leaders underneath you are those that take total ownership. They don't just run into problems and report problems. They run into problems and say, hey, I had this problem. Here's the solution I either did or I proposed that we do for all of our customers. And then their broadening influence is not just with their boss, but with other organizations. Now, I think you have to manage that a little carefully. You don't necessarily want every CSM running over to the product team and saying, here's all the things that you should do. We probably want to funnel that up to the manager. But I think the manager of the onboarding team, their job is more internal out to the other organizations than it is down to their team and out to those customers. Because I've always thought as a manager, my job is to make the people who report to me, make their job easier. And that usually involves going around the company and getting everyone else to participate in a way that makes their job easier. We make customer success easier by building a better product, by having a better onboarding experience, by setting expectations better in sales. So that's my primary job, is to make those things happen so that my CSMs can just go do their jobs.
Right.
So own it. Own it and don't be shy about it. You'll be a more valuable employee. You'll be respected if you do that in the right way. You can't just own it with a sledgehammer. You got to own it with a velvet glove. For sure, that's part of what you have to do. If you're doing influence management, there's a real skill to that. But if you own it and you do that in the right way, you'll make the whole company much better, not just that customer who you're onboarding right now.
Great. Well, Dan, I really appreciate your time today. I really do. This was an illuminating conversation for me, and I hope for everyone listening as well.
Great. I'm so glad. It's so much fun to talk about this because I'm a firm believer that the first 90 days sets a tone for everything. And I think I've talked to so many companies, and I would say without equivocation, 70% of all churn can be traced back to the first 90 days of the customer's experience. And so if we can get that right, we can have such a huge impact on the long-term value of our company and the financials and everything else. So I'm glad you guys want to talk about onboarding because it's such a critical time in the customer life cycle.
Yep. We do love talking about it.
Yes, we do. I love it too.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Good. Yeah. Thank you. It's so much fun.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you have questions, comments, or want to share your top learning from today's episode, tweet us at TaskRay or message us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes and let us know your favorite part. Until next time, you've been listening to the Customer Onboarding Podcast, brought to you by TaskRay, the customer onboarding success company.